This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The largest women's conference in history is in progress in China. Delegates to the 4th UN Conference on Women are gathered in Beijing. The unofficial part of the conference, attended by representatives of non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, wrapped up today in Wairo, which is over 30 miles away from Beijing. To get a sense of what the conference has been like so far, we called Vicky Kuei, who reports for WHYY Radio and NPR. She's traveled to China before with her father, a doctor who grew up in China and then emigrated to the United States. Vicky Kuei has been staying at a hotel in Beijing. I asked her if it's been difficult to get back and forth between Beijing and Wairo.
I felt very strongly that we should not be in a journalist hotel. And when I got to the airport, they tried to tell me I had to go to one, but I refused, and we came to this hotel instead. It has been difficult because, first of all, you have to hire a taxi if you don't take a shuttle. And the shuttles only run at certain times, so most of the time I've been getting up early in the morning, going down and haggling with the taxi drivers, to get them to lower their rates, because basically when they knew the conference came, they raised all their rates. So in each and every morning, my producer, Laura, has been upstairs kind of embarrassed, while I'm down there saying, no, 151 and no more. But it has been difficult because on top of that, Beijing is a city of construction and bicycles. Everywhere you look, there is construction. And then there's a lot of traffic on top of it. And sometimes you sit in traffic and you don't move for, a good 25 minutes. And it is frustrating.
Vicky, why do you feel so strongly about not staying in a journalist hotel?
Because I know the Chinese government, and I also felt that I didn't want to be in a place where everything was set up for me. I also knew that if I were in a journalist hotel, the workers there would be a lot more, the workers would not be as free with their ideas, and they wouldn't talk to me as a person, they would talk to me as a journalist. And here, it wasn't until really a couple of days ago that people started calling me, saying, hello, journalist Vicky, or journalist Kuei. A lot of the women who work in the hotel have been very friendly, and they have opened up to me.
I think there's about 4,000 journalists at the conference. Has it been very frustrating to be in a place where there's at least 3,999 other people on the story?
I didn't realize, I didn't feel how many other journalists there were here until yesterday when Hillary Clinton came to speak at the NGO Forum. And I can tell you that we were all standing outside in the pouring rain waiting to get into this building where they had moved her speech to because of the rain. And we went to the side door, and there were a whole bunch of us underneath umbrellas, holding our umbrellas, banging on the door trying to get in. And this Chinese guard said, there's no press entrance. You have to all go through the front. And in front, there was just a sea of colorful umbrellas, all these women wanting to get in to see Hillary Clinton. And so they basically told us you have to push your way through these women and, get up to the balcony. So I was just kind of following some of the other journalists. All of a sudden, some of the international press start pushing from behind, and they're pushing us on top of these other women standing in line, and then the Chinese guards came and they were pushing from the front, and I honestly felt that we were going to, that there was going to be some kind of stampede, and I was holding on to this elderly, not elderly, but an older journalist next to me, and she was a little bit more frail, and I just kept saying, make sure you stay on your feet, make sure you stay on your feet, because if we trip and we fall here, we're going to be dead. We're going to be trampled. And it was really frightening. I guess that's really when I realized just how many other journalists there were there. And it was pretty ugly.
It's moments like that where you have to ask yourself, how important is it for you to get into the building and hear Hillary Clinton?
It was not that important to me. I can be quite honest about that. It was important to a lot of the women there. And I can say that there were women from every country imaginable standing in line in the rain to see Hillary Clinton. But to me, it was not worth that kind of action. It was really ugly. I honestly feel that it was the ugly side of humanity there occurring.
But did you make it in?
I did, and actually, I was standing outside, and I was pretty frightened, and this Chinese guard saw me, and he let me in. And some of the other journalists, I don't think, liked that, but he did let me in. He kind of just pulled me in, and that kind of thing's been happening a lot, I should say. I have gotten interviews with people here that I know I would not have gotten if I didn't have a Chinese face.
Have many women told you stories about their lives or about the significance of attending this conference for them?
Oh, yeah. Some of them tell me about having saved up for, you know, a couple of years just to be able to come here, you know, having taken a huge financial debt load on just to be able to come. A lot of them tell me that they just wanted to be able to talk to other women to find out, you know, other women activists to find out how they approached a situation in a garment factory or how they approached problems with AIDS in women, that kind of thing. There's been a sense of urgency on the part of many of the women, and it's very common when you're talking with a group of people for somebody to just come up and say, "Hi, I'm such and such, and are you talking about AIDS? Are you talking about this?" You know, it's really been incredible. They're not shy at all, and that's one of the things that I've really liked about this.
What are some of the stories that you've been moved by that other women have told you about their lives?
I talked to a woman who works with women in sub-Saharan Africa. And she was telling me that when she first went to a village, she was attending a birth where a woman died in childbirth. The child made it, and the father named the child Sacrifice. And she said she was deeply hurt, but at the same time she was touched by the fact that he named her Sacrifice and that he acknowledged what had happened to his wife, that kind of thing. And she said then she found out that there were a whole bunch of children in that village that were named Sacrifice. And I was very touched by that. I spoke with a chief of a tribal chief of a village in southwest Nigeria, who told me about this program that she designed to help women there start up their own businesses. Because in where she's from, it's tribal custom that the land is handed down from father to son, and women are excluded from owning property. So, but at the same time, they can't get loans from banks because they have nothing to offer as collateral. So she, at one point, gave a group of women from a village part of her salary, which only amounted to about $45 US, to buy some machines that they needed to start a processing plant for cassava and palm oil. And they were a huge success, and then she told them, give your capital gains to another group of women, and they did. And now she's founded this group called the Country Women's Association of Nigeria, and last year they had 4,500 members and loaned about $6.7 million to women in rural, poor villages of Nigeria, and I just thought that was fascinating.
If you're just joining us, my guest speaking to us by phone from Beijing is Vicky Kuei. She's in Beijing covering the 4th World Conference on Women. Vicky, your father is Chinese. Do people in China assume that you are from China, and is that affecting how you're being treated?
Yeah, they do. They come up to me, and they immediately start speaking in Mandarin, and they do assume that I'm Chinese, and yeah, like I said before, I have gotten interviews that I don't think I would have normally have gotten if I didn't have a Chinese face, simply because I think a lot of the Chinese women here are afraid to talk to, you know, some of the international women here. They really don't want to talk to journalists. A lot of journalists have told me they haven't gotten any decent interviews with any Chinese women. And I was able to sit down with a 73-year-old Tibetan woman and talk with her. And I asked her after I was done, you know, why did you do the interview with me? And she was speaking to a translator. And she told me, because you look like my granddaughter. And she gave me a pin. She wanted to give me this pin that she had made. Said, you know, because her granddaughter had died, that she wanted me to have the pin because she thought I had probably a piece of her granddaughter's soul. So that was pretty moving, too.
Yeah. Now, I know your grandmother's feet were bound. Did she ever move to the United States, or did she stay in China?
No, she never moved to the United States.
Did you see her feet?
I was very little when I saw her feet, and actually, I remember asking my dad, I was very little, but I remember saying, you know, why does she walk so funny? And she had always been, you know, a foreigner to all of us, and in a very strange way, all of our Chinese relatives have always been sort of foreigners to my sisters and my brother and I. And my mother's side of the family, my mother is Puerto Rican, had always been grandma and grandpa, you know, and Uncle Vinny and Aunt Magali. So, they've always been strange to us. And I had asked my father, why does she walk so funny? And he had said, well, you know, they did something to her feet when young, and went on to say, you know, her feet were bound. And I remember thinking when I was a little girl how horrible, and then reading about it later on and becoming absolutely engrossed in reading all I could and actually getting out, you know, sheets one day and cutting them up and trying to figure out how this happened.
Did you see her feet?
Yes, I did.
What did they look like?
They were swollen. And then this was years later after being unbound. She still didn't walk right. They were broken.
As we record now, it's nighttime for you in Beijing. What are your plans for tomorrow?
I am taking my producer, Laura Jackson, to the Great Wall of China. She's never been to China ever before. She definitely wants to see the Great Wall, and I cannot let her leave China without seeing the Great Wall and at least the Forbidden City. I definitely want her to see that because all she's seen so far are the traffic jams, the construction, the bamboo scaffolding, and, you know, the hassles we've had with certain people here. And I want her... I have the feeling that I don't think she has a good impression of China, and it's really important to me that she sees some of the beauty as well.
Vicky Kuei spoke to us from Beijing. She's a reporter for WHYY Radio and NPR. We'll hear from a woman who studies women's movements around the world after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Amrita Basu, is the editor of a book commissioned by the Ford Foundation about women's movements in 23 countries. It's called The Challenge of Local Feminisms. She's a professor of political science and women's and gender studies at Amherst College. Both of her parents are from India and worked for the UN. Her mother was a member of the UN Secretariat and helped organize the first UN World Conference on Women, which was held in Mexico in 1975. Basu has attended two of the four UN World Conferences on Women. She says these international conferences have shown that there is no monolithic model of feminism. Women in developing countries have different needs than women in industrialized countries. I asked her if she thinks this realization works against the sense of unity you'd expect international conferences to produce.
I think in the past that women from the post-colonial world in particular found the notion of global sisterhood to be extremely oppressive because it assumed a sameness in the problems of women. And I think most often because it denied attention to problems of class inequality, poverty, imperialism that women in the post-colonial world experienced. So I think the positive aspect of this development is that feminism has become more local, or at least more locally articulated, that although there are certain broad themes that run through women's movements in various parts of the world, women have been able to address them in very different ways, sometimes in the context of social movements, which are inclusive of men or often even led by men, sometimes in the context of environmental movements. It's very striking, for example, in India or in Kenya, the green movement, movements against deforestation, have been a very important form of arena in which women can express opposition to gender inequality.
You've been studying women's movements around the world. Why are you studying them? What are you looking for?
Well, I suppose that most scholarship is autobiographical, and in part, I became interested in this question from through the influence of my mother, who was a very strong and still is a very strong and independent woman. She influenced me, I think, both in her own attempt to resist social conventions as she was growing up. She refused to have an arranged marriage. She fought hard to continue her education. She ended up working for the United Nations in the branch on women's rights. So she was a very important influence in my life, and my sister and I accompanied her as she attended conferences on women's rights and human rights around the world as we grew up.
Earlier this week in China, when Hillary Clinton spoke, she referred to a practice in India that's known as dowry death. She said, "It's a violation of human rights when women are doused with gasoline, set on fire, and burned to death because their marriage diaries are deemed too small." What do you know about this practice?
Well, it's still extremely pervasive. This is the practice that really brought into being the women's movement. The first forms of organized women's protest took place in opposition to dowry deaths. In fact, the Indian newspapers would carry accounts of women who had accidentally burned to death while cooking because kerosene had spilled on their saris and they had caught on fire. And some women's organizations in the late 1970s began to investigate these cases and found that, of course, these were not accidents at all, but these were cases of women's having been murdered. The early attempts of the women's movement in the late 70s and early 1980s was to try and make public these very privatized actions. Apparently, what would often happen is that the in-laws, often the mother-in-law was complicit in this, along with her son-in-law, would both be present at the time and would douse the daughter-in-law, the bride, with kerosene and kill her. And this often took place after a long period in which they had been harassing her, claiming that the dowry they had received at the time of marriage was insufficient and demanding that she return to her family to get a larger dowry. What was also shocking is that very often these young women would return to their families and would tell them that they were being harassed or tortured, and their parents would advise their daughters to go back and tell them things would get better, which of course they didn't. So the tactic that women's organizations used was of shaming families publicly, of going outside their homes, of calling for them to come out on the streets and naming them, so that it was no longer possible for them to find refuge in their homes. What I think is disturbing, however, is that although the women's movement is very active around this issue, dowry deaths continues to be an extremely important problem in North India and now in parts of South India as well.
Now, is dowry death illegal?
Yes, it is. In fact, the practice of the dowry is illegal, but the laws against dowry are so filled with loopholes that they've been utterly worthless.
I guess that's part of what international women's movements are up against, is even when there is a law on the books that makes it a criminal action to practice a crime against a woman, whether it's rape or murder, it doesn't mean that the practice is going to end.
That's absolutely right. And I think these international conferences have come under a lot of criticism for being expensive affairs, for being inefficient means of getting work done. But I think that one of the things that they do is to galvanize attention on a global scale to these continuing horrors that women face.
You know, one of the themes now in the international women's movement is that women's rights are a part of human rights.
Right.
How close do you think we are to having some kind of international agreement on that?
I think, depressingly, we're still quite far from that. The fact that the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women has still not been ratified suggests that, when that puts forward some basic women's rights. So I think that, one of the things that has been striking to me in reading through the report, particularly of the Human Development Report, which was published by the UNDP, is that in very large parts of the world, women have not achieved many fundamental legal rights, the right to own property, the right to travel without the permission of their husbands outside of their countries. So I think we tend to assume that those basic legal rights have been achieved, and we can go on from there, and that's still not the case.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Amrita Basu is the editor of The Challenge of Local Feminisms. She's a professor at Amherst College. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.